Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Talking about The Red and the Black, Book 1, Chapter 3? Wait, what are we up to? Chapter 3. Renal wants to kick out an 80-year-old man. Nice. And the other discussion prompt was, we get a description of Madame de Renal. What do you think of her? Swim said the Mumfishy said regarding Madame de Renal, I am reserving an opinion regarding Madame de Renal for now. Lol. After Anna, Claire and Emma from the last three books, I'm burnt out on marriage drama. Oh yeah. Hear, hear. Amen. I hope it's not another marriage drama book. It's gonna be though, isn't it? It just is. Altreat said, tell me about it. Hemingway apparently couldn't get enough of it. I like to imagine him as a fan of couples therapy and The Bachelor.
He would love The Bachelor.
He would love it. And Maths, as we call it. There's a dumb Australian show called Married at First Sight, which, I don't know. The housewife crew love, you know. The what do they call it? Reality TV type. It's all about either cooking or dating. Star415 says, life imitating fiction. This was his life. He kept starting affairs, divorcing, marrying his lover, then starting another affair, and on and on. Chan Brunt says, for such a self-proclaimed manly man, he sure does love romance stories. Lexi said, when I read that she was bored with her husband, I groaned. Yeah, it's been done to death. Hemingway's like, it's either that he really loved that kind of story, or it's just like that was the only kind of story that existed back then. But for real, like, there's nothing like on Hemingway's reading list that's like out there. There's no like Greek, you know, tragedies or any old myths or Don Quixote or any kind of adventure or, you know, Beowulf, anything with a bit of fantasy element to it. It's all just kind of high society European marriage drama so far. So that's interesting to note. Hadn't really thought of that till now. The schmoop.com summary for the previous chapter, chapter 3 I should say, was this. We look in on a guy called Monsieur Appert, who has been sent from Paris to meet with a local priest named Father Chelan. I'm sorry, I'm scratching my arm furiously right now. Something's bitten me on my arm. It's just the price of living in Australia, is you get bug bites. We look in on a guy. Okay, I've read that. It sounds like the two of them need to visit the prison for some mysterious business. The father seems especially annoyed about something that's going on. Monsieur Appert visits the prisons with Chelan. He never says a word the whole time. When the two of them visit the prison a second time that day, the guard says he received orders not to let them in. Father Chelan scolds him until he lets them pass. Meanwhile, we find out that the mayor, Ronchold Renal, and another man named Valenod want to get Chelan removed from the district because he doesn't play ball with them politically. When the two tell Chelan the news, he answers that he'll never leave the community. He'll live there, even in retirement, just to shame de Renal and Valenod about what they've done. For crying out loud, the guy is 80 years old. Later on, the mayor's wife asks him what harm it could do to let Chelan keep his job, but the conversation quickly turns to the fact that the mayor wants a special tutor to teach their children. It's a matter of pride, since having a private tutor is a symbol of wealth, just like owning a Porsche or a big house. The mayor is eager to have the town talking about how well off he is. The person the mayor wants to hire is the son of the sawmill owner Sorel. The narrator gives us a short description of Madame de Renal, telling us that she's a beautiful woman who can't admit to herself that she finds her husband boring. She has never known anything other than obedience and shyness, so she can't even imagine what love is supposed to look like. Nematod says, my first impression of the wife is that she's too innocent for her own good. Perhaps we will see her wiliness, or maybe she's being set up for some real disappointment. Tekrovic said, I read somewhere that the epigraphs are supposed to be interpreted more on the emotional side. It renders a mood to the chapter. Sometimes it indicates a summary of a theme or of an important reflection. So far, this has panned out. The Danton quote indicated the idea of the two truths. The chapter one quote was about the bleakness of urban life. The chapter two quote was about the prestige and reputation Monsieur Renal's, and that chapter spoke specifically about his prideful nature. We get an idea about where his priorities lie. Chapter 3 is about virtue, and we instantly think about the curé, since he's mentioned first, but later we realise it's Madame de Renal's virtue to quote that the quote is alluding to. I think we can say more about the style of writing now that we have three chapters under our collective belt. It's exposition interspersed by interludes of short action. I wonder if this is the way the whole novel is constructed. I can see and attentively shifting his weight on his chair. Oh no, mate, is this going to be another instance of tell and not show, a la the Brothers Karamazov? It's certainly a mix so far, but it leans heavily to the side of tell and sometimes show, so it will be interesting to hear and his take on it. My take on it so far is it hasn't... I haven't noticed, so I suppose if you don't notice, then the balance is pretty good in terms of showing and telling. That whole show don't tell thing, people go too far with it and they bore you to death by showing you at length something that they can just say. You know, you can say it was raining, and I know what rain looks like. You don't have to allude to rain in a long description without saying rain, you know. Or there's all different kinds of meanings to the show don't tell thing. It's not just about description, but if the balance is too far either way, you'll notice, and I haven't noticed yet. So I'd say, I think so far, and I mean, it might be down to the translation a bit, because that makes a huge difference, but so far I haven't had any issue with pace or prose style. The first two chapters were very exposition-y, but they were also the first two chapters in a pretty long novel, so you can kind... And it's also, you know, written in the early 1800s when the old books... It's like, I can't remember where I picked this up. Someone told me this a long, long time ago, a teacher or something. But there was a thing with old novels that they would include lots of detail, lots of exposition, lots of description, and even these like litany, like lists of like names, and like if a character stumbles across a page full of names, the book will then list all those names even though you don't know who the heck they are, and things like that. Like, it would just pad, and the reason they did that was almost for like a value for money thing. Like, if you had a book back in that day, it was very difficult to purchase a book. And so when you got one, you wanted it to really last a long time. And so those books like Moby Dick and, I don't know, whatever, they are made deliberately a lot longer so that the reader gets better value for money. Right. Someone told me that once. And so they were like, essentially, when you read an old book, they will move very, very slowly. It's because they didn't have short attention spans like we do now. They wanted it to last as long as possible, because otherwise what else did they have to do? Sit around the house and wait for the rain to stop. So I give a little forgiveness for that too, in that it's an old book, so the pace is going to be slower. It's just the way it was back then. So all that said, my take on it, it's good. I'm fine with the writing style so far. All right, let's move on. I was wondering also, says Tekrovic, about the voice of the narrator. Sometimes it's a dispassionate yet dryly humorous omniscient narrator, but in chapter 2 there was an instance of first-person narration. Anyone else having any thoughts or insights about this? I kind of like it so far. You know, I didn't catch the first-person narration. I must have missed it. So chapter 3 introduces Madame de Renal. I can easily see what modern sentiments are, and in particular certain kinds of literary criticism would have to say about her, but I chose to see her as portrayed and not question it too critically yet, and I already like her a lot. Did anyone else think of Anna Karenina? I didn't think of Anna Karenina, but I did think kind of just like those warning bells of like, unhappy wife, is this another one of those kind of things? Like all the other books on this bloody list. All right. one last comment, actually. I'll read this one by Jan Brunt. Jan Brunt said, for social and political context on the novel, I highly recommend the Revolutions podcast. Season 3, The French Revolution and the Rise of Napoleon, and Season 6, The Restoration and the July Revolution, are a really deep dive into the issues that are important background to this book. Very cool. All right. I'm going to add them to my list, my podcasting list. How do I do that? I'm going to do it while I'm talking. Just looking at my Podbean app. This podcast is brought to you by Podbean. It actually is hosted on Podbean. What is it? Revolutions. I'm just doing it now, because if I don't do it now, I will forget. Revolutions. I think I found it. How do you find the seasons? I suppose you just... Oh, you just scroll. very cool. All right. Season 3 goes for a long time. It's like 40 episodes. All right. Cool. How do I, like, bookmark it or whatever? Follow. There we go. On that, Patreon. Patreon.com/TheHemingwayList if you want to support this podcast. You can do that for as little as $1 per month. Patreon.com/TheHemingwayList. Big thanks to all the Patreons who are supporting the upkeep of this little project. Now, let's read the next chapter. Okay. Where are we? Oh, yeah. I'm trying to find the window. I'm like alt-tabbing, or whatever that's called on a Mac. Command-tabbing. And then I realize that I'm reading an actual book with paper. And the book was sitting in front of me. Chapter 4 is called Father and Son. And the foreword of it is in Italian, I think. It says, I sera mia colpa se così è. And that's a Machiavelli quote. Machiavelli. My wife really has an excellent head on her shoulders, said the mayor of Verrieres to himself as he walked down the Perisol's mill at 6 o'clock the following morning. Whatever it was I said to her in order to maintain my due superiority, I hadn't dreamt that if I don't secure this little Abe Sorel, who they say knows Latin like an angel, then the director of the poorhouse, that pushy fellow, is quite capable of having the same idea and stealing him from me. In what smug tones he will talk of his children and children's tutor. Now this tutor, once he is at my house, will he wear a soutane? Monsieur de Renal was taken up with this speculation when he caught sight of a peasant in the distance, a man of nearly 6 foot, who in the early morning light seemed entirely absorbed in measuring pieces of wood disposed on the towpath along the Doubs. This peasant did not appear at all pleased to see the approach of Monsieur le Maire, for the pieces of wood obstructed the way and were placed there contrary to regulations. Père Sorel, for it was he, was very surprised and still more gratified at the singular proposition put to him by Monsieur de Renal concerning his son Julien. He heard it, even so, with that air of melancholy discontent and indifference with which the peasants of these mountains are so adept at cloaking their cunning. Slaves in the period of Spanish rule, they still retain the facial expression of the Egyptian fellahin. Sorel's response, at first, was nothing more than a lengthy recital of the deferential formulae he had by rote. While he repeated these empty phrases with an unnatural smile, reinforcing the air of insincerity, almost a rascality natural to his face, the busy mind of the old peasant sought to fathom what motive could have brought so considerable a man to take his worthless son into his own house. He was extremely dissatisfied when Julien, and it was for him that Monsieur de Renal offered the unlooked-for wage of 300 francs a year, plus food and even clothing. This last daring demand, which Père Sorel had the genius to put forward suddenly, had as quickly been accepted by Monsieur de Renal. The demand impressed the mayor. Since Sorrel is not delighted and bowled over by my proposition, as naturally he ought to be, it is obvious, said he to himself, that he has received offers from another party, and where could they come from if not from Valinod? It was in vain that Monsieur de Renal urged Sorel to conclude the deal on the spot. The old peasant's cunning obstinately refused that he wished, he said, to consult his son. As if in the provinces a rich father consults a penniless son, other than as a matter of form. A water-powered sawmill is made up of a shed on the bank of a stream. The roof is supported by a framework carried on four thick wooden pillars. 8 or 10 feet up in the middle of the shed, one sees a saw which moves up and down while a very simple machine pushes a piece of wood against it. A wheel driven by the stream moves these dual mechanisms, that of the saw which goes up and down, and that of the device which gently pushes the piece of wood towards the saw which cuts it into planks. Approaching his mill, Père Sorel called out to Julien in his stentorian voice. Nobody replied. He saw only his older sons, giant-like men, who, armed with heavy axes, were squaring off the pine trunks they were going to take to the saw. Completely absorbed in following precisely the black lines marked on the piece of wood, each blow of their axes would chip off enormous chunks. They did not hear their father's call. He turned towards the shed. Entering, he looked in vain at the place by the saw where Julien should have been stationed. Then he saw him 5 or 6 feet above it, astride one of the roof beams. Instead of carefully supervising the workings of the whole process, Julien was reading. Nothing was more antipathetic to old Sorel than this. He might have forgiven the slender build, so little fitted to manual labour, and so different from that of his brothers, but this mania for reading was odious to him, who didn't know how to read. He called Julien 2 or 3 times with no effect. The attention the young man gave to his book, much more than the noise of the saw, prevented his hearing his father's terrible voice. At last, despite his age, the latter leapt nimbly onto the tree trunk being worked by the saw, and from there to the crossbeam supporting the roof. A violent blow made the book Julien was holding fly into the stream. A second blow, just as violent and in the form of a box on the ear, made him lose his balance. He was about to fall 12 or 15 feet down into the midst of the moving machine levers, which would have crushed him, but his father caught him by the left hand as he fell. "Well, idler, so you still read your damn books when you're supposed to be looking after the saw? Read them in the evening when you go and waste time with the curé. That'd be all right." Julien, though stunned by the force of the blow and all bloody, returned to his official station by the saw. He had tears in his eyes, caused less by physical pain than by the loss of his book, which he adored. "Come down, you animal, so I can talk to you." The roar of the mechanism still prevented Julien from hearing the order. His father, who had descended and didn't want to bother of climbing up the machine again, went to find a long rod for knocking down walnuts and rapped him on the shoulder with it. Julien had hardly touched the ground when old Sorel, driving him roughly in front, pushed him towards the house. "God knows what he'll do with me," said the young man to himself. In passing, he looked sadly at the stream where his book had fallen. It was the only one. It was the one he loved the most, the Memorials of St. Helena. His cheeks were heavily flushed and his eyes lowered. He was a slight young man of 18 or 19, weak in appearance, with irregular but delicate features and an aquiline nose. The great dark eyes, which in more peaceful moments proclaimed thoughtfulness and fire, were at that moment animated by an expression of the fiercest hatred. Dark chestnut hair, worn very far down, gave him a low forehead, and when he was angry, a wicked look. Among the innumerable varieties of human physiognomy, none, perhaps, could be marked by so striking an individuality. A graceful, well-proportioned figure suggested more of litheness than of strength. From his early childhood, his excessively pensive air and his extreme pallor had given his father the idea that he wouldn't live long, or that he would live only to be an expense to his family. Despised by the whole household, he hated his brothers and his father. In the Sunday games, on the public square, he would always be beaten. It was less than a year ago that his pretty face had begun to earn him some friendly feelings among the girls. Scorned by everyone as a feeble creature, Julien had worshipped the old surgeon major, who once dared to speak to the mayor on the subject of plane trees. Sometimes the surgeon had paid Pere Sorel for a day of his son's time and taught him Latin and history, that is to say, what he knew of history, the campaign in Italy in 1796. Dying, he had left him his cross of the Legion of Honour, the arrears of his half pay, and 30 or 40 books, the most precious of which had just flown into that public stream diverted through the influence of the mayor. Julian had scarcely entered the house when he felt his shoulder grabbed by his father's powerful hand. He trembled, expecting some blows. "Answer me without lying," shouted the hard voice of the old peasant in his ear, while his hand turned him round as a child's hand turns a lead soldier. Julian's great tear-filled eyes found themselves facing straight into the small spiteful eyes of the old carpenter, who had the air of wanting to read him to the depths of his soul. Alright, there we go. Another chapter down. Introduction to a nice character there. Very nicely done. Feel bad for him losing that book. Alright, have your say about this one over at the subreddit. Thank you very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.